Please be seated. Calling our third case for today, 038P3349, Sauk County v. Aaron J.J. Arguing on behalf of Aaron J.J. is Antoinette H. Is it Leitch? Leitch. And Chad A. Hendy, Sauk County Corporation Counsel of Baraboo, will argue on behalf of Sauk County. Ms. Leitch.
Good afternoon. I am Toni Leitch, and I do represent Aaron J.J., the petitioner in this matter. Today we're here, I'm here to encourage the court to expand the 14th Amendment due process protections to subjects who are under Chapter 51 to include that prior to accepting a waiver of a trial and a stipulation to the ultimate commitment, that the court engage in a personal colloquy with the individual to ensure that that waiver and stipulation is a knowing and voluntary stipulation and waiver.
What practical effect will this have? I was a circuit judge for 14 years, 13 plus, and had many 51s. And I remember that in some of them I could see perhaps this working. In some where there is a real lack of understanding, and some of them are very, very volatile hearings. How do you propose, if you have someone in a catatonic state and you ask he or she questions, how is that going to work?
Well, obviously the practical effect is going to be more litigation. It's going to be requiring the county to be put to its burden of proof.
Does it give the 51 person two kicks at the cat? In other words, if you can say you understood but you really didn't understand, if you're...
Well, quite frankly, Justice, that occurs in any person who stipulates and waives, who is competent to do so. Well, they have two kicks.
Isn't that the difficulty? How do we overcome the question of if it's up to the judge to decide whether the person was or is not competent, correct?
Yes, it is.
And then what happens if the judge says he or she is and he or she says, no, I didn't understand. I was under the influence of another god at the time, or some influence that we don't know of. I mean, I've seen many things happen at these hearings.
Certainly, as have I at the trial court level. I guess that's just what's going to happen. Someone who is competent to waive their right to a jury trial in a criminal matter can come back and say, no, I wasn't in my right mind.
I don't think it's the same. Do you see a difference between this, the Bangor-type hearing, the Bangor-type...
If you encounter the person with a mental health issue, certainly. But just because you're attempting to protect the individual or because you're trying to do something good for them doesn't mean that constitutional rights shouldn't be adhered to.
Well, I understand that. And how many other jurisdictions, states, have changed and gone? We've had Lessard, which I certainly think was a very positive step, but have this colloquy?
Not too many.
Well, what does that mean? Is that one or five? Or?
Quite frankly, I'm not certain of all the states that have it.
Are there any?
I am not certain.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. I do have a question. I just want to make sure I understand the scope of your argument. Is it your position that you're arguing that in every 51 proceeding, there should be a colloquy to determine whether or not the individual is competent? Or are you asking us to find that there should be a colloquy where there's evidence that an individual may be incompetent?
I believe in every case there should be a colloquy. And in this particular case, I think that there were red flags to the trial court that perhaps this waiver was not knowing and intelligently made, based on the fact that 10 days earlier there was a finding that Aaron was not capable of applying and understanding to the advantages and disadvantages of taking medication.
But in the absence of the red flags, you still think there should be a colloquy in all 51 proceedings?
I believe that that would have to be the case. I don't believe that you could be selective in when and when it shouldn't occur.
If a person is a petition for involuntary commitment, does that mean a person is incompetent to make a decision about selling property, making a will, deciding? I'll just leave it at that.
Oh, no, it doesn't mean that the person is incompetent. In fact, the legislature presumes that person is competent.
So the person is in court on a petition for involuntary commitment, and the presumption is, or at least concept is, that person is competent
to
make a variety of decisions, but that person might not be competent to determine his or her own medication.
That's correct.
So
in this particular case.
Well, it is, but just generally, I'm talking about general. So a person might be competent to say, look, I am concerned that I might be a danger to my family. I recognize that I committed violence to a member of my family. I'm concerned. I therefore will not fight the petition to commit me for 6 months, which is what happens, right?
Correct.
A bond. I don't want you to give me any psychotropic medication.
I think that someone could, in fact, be in a position
to be competent
in one case and not competent in the other.
So your position is that under any conditions, whether the person indicates incompetency for making a decision or not, you do the colloquy?
I believe so. I believe so, yes.
Because it's a significant intrusion on personal liberty.
That's correct, and the intrusion is incredibly significant. Not only are you giving up to your right to determine what sort of mental health treatment you're going to receive, you're giving up your right to determine where you're going to receive it, whether you'll be in the community, you'll be hospitalized, you'll be institutionalized, whether you can move from the community-based treatment to hospitalization without some sort of overt act. You're giving up your right to, in some cases, lose your right to a firearm. You're giving up your right to the whole procedure of the Chapter 51, being it's a 6-month commitment. It can be extended.
Okay, suppose the judge has this colloquy and says this person is not competent to determine is not competent to stipulate. So now what do? We go to trial.
Yes.
Is the person competent to stay in trial?
Is the person competent to stay in trial?
Yeah. I mean, the general rule in criminal cases, if you're not competent to stay in trial, you don't stand trial. So if the guy can't stipulate because he's incompetent to make that decision, what's the alternative? Put him in until he's fit to make the decision?
I think that
I'm trying to say to you, if he's incompetent to stipulate, how is he competent to help his lawyer in a trial?
Well,
and do you have to give him a jury trial because he's not competent to waive jury trial?
I believe so. I believe he would have to. And in terms of competency to stand trial, that's a different standard as to whether or not you are knowingly and intelligently waiving your right to the trial. In terms of, do you know the consequences? Do you subjectively understand what you're giving up and what is going to happen as a result of that? I think that's definitely different than whether or not you can aid your counsel in representing you.
Counselor, just because you stipulate to the grounds for commitment, that doesn't mean you've stipulated to not refusing certain kinds of treatment, correct?
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
Well, under the Patient's Bill of Rights in 51.61, you have the right to refuse different types of treatments. And just because you've stipulated to the grounds for commitment, it seems to me it's a different question than whether that stipulation somehow engenders a lack of ability on your part to object to the treatment.
Well, if the basis of the lack of ability to object to the treatment is that your mental illness is, your judgment is so clouded by your mental illness that you're not capable of applying an understanding of the advantages and disadvantages of the medication, that's a different standard.
But that's not what he stipulated to. He stipulated to the grounds for commitment, as I understand it, based on dangerousness to self or others. Or am I wrong?
And he, maybe he would have been able to do that, but we don't know. We don't know whether or not he understood.
We're not talking to each other. Let me try again. What you are contesting is the stipulation to the grounds for commitment, correct?
The stipulation to the grounds for commitment and the waiver of the right to a hearing, yes.
Yes, okay. But what really caused the complaint here was the treatment that was proposed for him, correct?
In this case, that's what caused him to dispute the treatment, yes.
Okay, and the reason there was a hearing, he objected to the treatment, there was a hearing, and the court found that he was not capable of understanding its beneficial nature and that it would be beneficial and ordered the treatment, correct?
Correct.
And it wasn't until after he was ordered to be treated by a method he didn't want that he then said, well, I'm going to back up now and say I shouldn't have been committed in the first instance, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so while it is necessary for the grounds for commitment to be established before you can get to the step of treatment, it doesn't necessarily follow that because you stipulate to the grounds for commitment, you are going to end up being treated in a way that you would prefer not to be treated.
No, it doesn't necessarily follow at all.
Counsel, I was taken aback by your statement of the issue because we on the court here are naturally conservative. You know, we move slowly. And you say, expand due process rights, proliferate litigation, and we hold on to the bench, you know.
Sure.
Okay. A couple of things come to mind. Number one, it seems to me what we're talking about here is not an expansion, arguably, is not an expansion of rights at all. That is, that under the statute, 5120, sub 5, there are rights that are accorded, according to the words of the statute, to address procedural due process. The essentials of due process is the language of the statute. And the rights that are accorded under the statute, let alone the Constitution. You know, that's another whole thing, the constitutional rights to due process. But the rights that are accorded under the statute making reference to due process, certainly, is that you have the right to have a hearing. You can have a closed hearing, you can have an open hearing. You can have a jury trial, but you have the right to have a hearing. And that's, under the terms of the statute, a due process right. So if you have that right, the question to me isn't necessarily are we going to expand the due process right, but what is necessary in order to waive that right? And that really seems to me to be what your argument is, that there must be a colloquy in order to waive the right. So I really don't see it as necessarily an expansion of a due process right.
I think the thought behind my term expanding the due process right is in response to the county's argument that there are certain statutory procedural due process rights. And because those due process rights in the statute don't address specifically the engaging of a colloquy to forego a liberty interest, that the court shouldn't recognize.
One of the fascinating things of this job is that you can take a same case and you can, with integrity, view it and develop so many statements of issues. The same case can be looked at so many different viewpoints. And one is, I think, exactly as you've just indicated, you know, whether or not, is there anything in the statute that talks about a due process right for a colloquy. Another way of stating the issue is, obviously, there's a due process right to a hearing. That's right in the statute. The question is, what has to be done to waive that due process right?
That's correct. That's what occurred in S.Y. with respect to the right to counsel. And
what did S.Y. say? I'm looking at S.B., those. I had to keep these S's straight here. With Racine County, what did Racine County say? And that was with regard to withdrawal of a jury demand.
Correct, and representing yourself.
Okay, and of course, under 5120 sub 5, to have the due process right under that statute to have a jury trial.
Correct.
And what was required to waive that due process right?
Correct, and the court found that because there was
what was required, if you know, if you're able.
What was required was a knowing and intelligent voluntary waiver.
How demonstrated? What I'm looking at.
Demonstrated by the colloquy to ensure.
Or by a written stipulation, right? In fact, it says here, the attorney may withdraw the demand if the attorney files in court the individual written consent to the withdrawal, or if the individual consents to the withdrawal personally in open court. The writing, if it's going to be done with the writing rather than an open court colloquy, the writing must state, number one, that the individual has made the decision to withdraw the demand knowingly and voluntarily after receiving the advice of counsel. After receiving the advice of counsel. That's what the writing has to say in withdrawing. Right. So my point is this. In that case, you have a due process right to a jury trial. No doubt about it. It has to, if you want to waive that right, what has to be done? And what's sufficient to waive a right?
What's sufficient to waive a right is a subjective showing that the person is doing it deliberately and that the person knows the consequences of what's going to be entailed by waiving that right.
I don't know that that's what the Racine County case said. Didn't it rely on the statute that said if you wanted a jury, the individual personally had to do it? And then the court reasoned, almost have the wrong case, the court reasoned that if you wanted it, you had to do it individually, and if you're going to withdraw it, the individual had to do it personally too, because a withdrawal is saying you don't want it. So that it was entirely statutory rather than intelligent and knowing and voluntary.
And that also dealt with the waiver of counsel and the person's ability to proceed on their own.
And the right to counsel is a statutory right.
Correct.
Counsel, I have a question about this statute and your argument about the colloquy and its whether or not it should be required. And I want to compare two statutes, and I want you to tell me whether you see a difference, and if so, how. 972.02, the jury trial waiver standard in criminal trials. Except as otherwise provided, criminal cases shall be tried by a jury as selected unless the defendant waives a jury in writing or by statement in open court. We go to 5120 sub 5. The hearings which are required to be held under this chapter shall conform to the essentials of due process and fair treatment, including the right to a jury trial if requested. Do you see any difference between the way those two statutes approach the rights of these two different individuals? 51 right where you have to request it versus criminal trial where you have the trial unless you formally waive it.
Do I see a difference? The difference being a waiver versus your right itself. The waiver, again, even in signing the piece of paper, you don't just sign a piece of paper and have the court rubber stamp it. So I do see that there is a difference.
Could I ask, could you narrate how this stipulation came to be? How did this develop? Am I correct, for example, that the stipulation was prepared by the Corporation Council?
I believe that there was discussion between Aaron and his attorney, and that there was a piece of paper that they looked at, and they had a discussion where it was determined that they would stipulate. The stipulation was presented to the court, and the court essentially, again, just rubber-stamped it.
But now, this occurred before the court hearing. In fact, it occurred the day before the court hearing, didn't it?
The agreement of Aaron and the signing of the stipulation, yes.
So they signed this on June 10th?
Definitely.
Aaron did, and counsel did?
That's my understanding.
And then it was brought back to the Corporation Council the next day?
I would assume for signature and presented to the court.
All right. Now, when was that language scratched out?
The language regarding the
medication.
The medication. I personally do not know, but from what I can tell on the record is probably that day that it was signed.
So the day that Aaron signed it?
The day that Aaron signed it. And what I'm assuming, having done mental commitment cases, is that the council went through the form, they decided what they were going to agree to and what they weren't going to agree to, and that was the ultimate decision.
So there, is it fair to infer there was discussion between Aaron and Aaron's counsel about what parts of the stipulation would be agreed to?
I think that's fair to be inferred, yes.
Now, the following day, was there a hearing on the part that wasn't agreed to?
Yes, what occurred was the next day the stipulation was presented to the judge. The judge accepted the stipulation and proceeded on the hearing on the medication.
Was that just to the court?
Pardon me?
Was that just to the court?
That was just to the court, yes.
Counsel, you've been telling us that due process would require a colloquy under the circumstances. What should be included in the colloquy?
I believe what should be included in the colloquy would be what are the consequences of being under a Chapter 51 commitment, that the person is going to be under a commitment for 6 months, that it can be extended for an additional 6 months, that it can't, there, a further extension can be requested by the county, that the burden of proof for that extension is significantly different than it is for the original extension and for the original commitment, that being that rather than be based on a recent dangerous act, it's based on a person's treatment record, that the commitment will result in the person being under the control of the Department of Human Services, who can then make the treatment decisions, make the decisions where that treatment will occur. And in some cases, that it could result in the loss of firearms.
Was it your position that there should have been a colloquy before there was the hearing on the medication, too?
I believe so. I believe that the court should have conducted a colloquy to ensure that the stipulation and waiver was voluntary and knowing. And if the court would find that that wasn't the case, then it should have proceeded with have been the court on or the trial on the ultimate Chapter 51 commitment, because quite frankly, you stipulate to the grounds, the commitment is going to be entered. So the sole basis for the commitment is somebody's agreement. And if they don't understand what they're agreeing to, and they don't understand the consequences of that agreement.
But maybe I'm not understanding you or you're not understanding me. Should there have been a colloquy about whether Aaron was prepared to go forward with the hearing on the other issue?
I don't believe so, because he wasn't waiving that right. He was proceeding with the right that
he
had.
How do we know he was competent, though, to assist his counsel?
How do you know he's competent at that point?
I think that's trying to follow up what the Chief was asking earlier.
You don't know, and that's why there should have been this colloquy to see if he was indeed competent to make that decision.
Counsel, oftentimes in commitment hearings, people are presented at the final hearing with a severe disability. They can be delusional, hallucinations, severe catatonic state, which by their very presence in behavior and appears that they cannot knowingly and voluntarily waive or consent to anything. They just are not able to do that. How should a court proceed? For an instance, there is the right to a jury trial. In those cases, whether it be 25% of the cases or a third of the cases, is a court required to have a call in a jury and have a jury trial because there can be no voluntary and knowing waiver?
I believe that the subject needs to request the jury trial.
Okay. Assume, as in this instance, which is standard operating procedure, at the probable cause hearing, the attorney says, Your Honor, we reserve the right for our jury trial, or we want to preserve the right for our jury trial. That's what happened here, and that's what happens normally. There's a request that's put in for a jury trial right at the end of the probable cause hearing. So let's assume that happened here. It did happen here. Let's assume it happens in my hypotheticals. That is, there's a request for a jury trial. It's been preserved, which is standard lingo at the end of a probable cause determination. At least I think it was. It used to be. So what do you do?
I think it's incumbent to proceed on a jury trial.
Is there an analysis in a case we've had in TPR, for instance, when I mean this analysis with respect. I mean, when someone has initially contested and then fails to appear, and we've said, well, look, the court has to at least put something on the record. Here, of course, at the final hearing, you would have already the reports of the doctors, or the doctors there live to testify, and the reports, most likely. Couldn't the judge say, okay, I'm going to incorporate into the records the medical reports of the doctors and make the necessary findings? What's wrong with that kind of procedure as to the grounds without calling a full jury?
If the request was made for a jury trial in front of the court, I don't see any other option then to proceed with the jury trial, have the county put on their evidence and be done with it. I don't think that the court can then say, well, because we find this person is not competent, he does and is not going to participate, that we'll just go on the record. I think the county has to meet its burden of proof.
What about appointing a guardian ad litem? Would that work? In other words, we've got the part of this case, as I said, you can look at it from different views. One statement of issue of this case is, what is the proper role of an attorney in a civil commitment proceeding when the client is incapable of assisting counsel or communicating desires?
I think that appointment of a guardian ad litem would certainly be warranted. We run into that in the TPR cases. We run into that in guardianship cases. If counsel doesn't believe that the person is able to make decisions, then maybe it's best to have a guardian ad litem represent that person's best interest. And certainly in this kind of case, when you're trying to protect the individual because of a mental illness, that the guardian ad litem role would certainly sink sufficiently.
Would that obviate the need for a jury trial if the guardian ad litem says, Your Honor, I don't think it's in the best interest of this client to have a jury trial. I mean, there's just no way that any defense can be presented. Look.
Well, actually, a guardian ad litem would never make that statement, but the guardian ad litem would say, yes, indeed, it would be in the ward's best interest or the subject's best interest to have this commitment. Yes. That may be a way out.
Do you know, and just to give us an idea, how many of these hearings we have in the state of Wisconsin in any one year?
I don't know how many, but I know we have a lot in Dane County, and I know we have a lot of them in a very short amount of time.
But what would it be fair to say, and I came from a central Wisconsin jurisdiction, that there are literally tens of thousands?
I would have guessed so, yes.
Okay, so if, and I'm just trying to follow the answers you gave to Justice Bradley, that in many of these cases, and we don't know whether it's 25 or 30 or 40%, what you're saying literally is that if there is, if you cannot find competency, there would have to be a jury trial.
Not necessarily a jury trial, again, in the mental commitment proceedings, it has to be requested. And I, but quite frankly, in Dane County, it's not wrote that a jury trial is requested. In fact, we very rarely request jury trials.
But what rights does the person who is being brought before the court have if who waives his or her right to a jury trial?
I don't know that waiver of a right to a jury trial is the same.
You said that you didn't think the guardian ad litem, they could suggest that it's in the best interest. I'm just wondering, if there isn't a guardian ad litem, what happens? Take me through the procedure. I think I understand it, but I'm just trying to, if there's a colloquy, which you're requesting, and then the judge, and let's say it's the people are in the capacity suggested by Justice Bradley, that they're not able to form any logical opinion, either one way or the other, and that's observed by the court, then where do we go from there?
Then we'd proceed and have the trial. Generally, again, at least in Dane County, it's not a jury trial. It can be a hearing that lasts anywhere from 15 minutes to a half an hour. The psychologists are put on. The officer, generally it's an officer or the...
Well, we bring in all of the... That's what I was trying to get at. Just and who are we protecting then?
We're protecting the individual's liberty interests. And despite the fact that it's meant to be protective, it really isn't in terms of the length of time the person could be subject to the commitment and in terms of the decisions that are being taken away from that individual.
I know your red light's been on, so I apologize for this. Any more questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Hendy?
May it please the court. My name is Chad Hendy, and I'm an assistant corporation counsel with Sauk County. At the table with me is Sauk County Corporation Counsel Todd Liebman. Aaron's due process rights were not violated in this case because a colloquy is not and should not be required before a person is allowed to stipulate to a civil commitment under Chapter 51. Just to be clear, we're discussing a situation where a person is wanting help. They are agreeing that they may be placed under a commitment. If they are fighting it, we don't get to this question at all. A colloquy isn't entered into because they proceed and the county is forced to put on their case.
Counsel, can't a person who wants help proceed under Section 5110?
Correct, under a voluntary
admission. And a voluntary commitment is very different from a voluntary admission, is it not?
Absolutely.
All right, so if a person is wanting help, as you indicate, but they're, unlike a voluntary admission where they're signing in and can sign out, they're signing in for, a six-month period, is that correct?
For treatment, yes.
For treatment, six-month period for treatment. Let's assume, for sake of this question, that we would agree that this type of colloquy that's being requested is not required in every case. Don't we have a very different situation here where we have a trial court that notes for the record that in addition to the testimony, the subject is on occasion was spinning around in his chair, making several revolutions, has not spoken, has made some sign language and rapping on the table during the course of the hearing. So what we have here is a situation where, unlike the typical 51, well, maybe it is, I don't know. But you've got a situation where a person is actually acting out in the courtroom. Doesn't a trial court have a very different responsibility in looking at an agreement to determine whether or not that agreement, given the deprivation of liberty interests involved, in that setting, is a knowing one?
Is what? I didn't
hear. A knowing one.
A knowing one.
A knowing agreement.
Just a little clarification, first of all. I believe the comment that the court made on the record regarding the not speaking and sitting in his chair, that was at the probable cause hearing. And that was on June 4th of 2003. The final hearing was not until June 11th, 2003, at which Aaron did testify on his own behalf. And there was not the same sorts of actions. And that goes along with the idea of the 51 realm, is that from probable cause through the final hearing, treatment is being provided to the person. Now, in Aaron's case, there actually were problems with the medication that they were trying for him, and there was a rash. So there was there was treatment going on, but it wasn't continued at the time of the final hearing.
When was the stipulation signed, do you know?
My understanding, it was signed by Aaron and his attorney on June 10th. And as I handled the hearing, his attorney presented it to me before the hearing, as she had seen him the day before, and again spoke with him before the actual final hearing was set.
As I recall the record here, there was a reservation of right for a jury trial at the time of the probable cause hearing. Is that your understanding?
I believe so.
Yeah. And so I think that it can arguably be interpreted, and then shortly thereafter, the jury trial notice went out. So obviously the court interpreted it as having a jury trial. When I look at the Racine County case, which deals with what's needed to waive a jury trial once requested, it provides for a colloquy in open court, or it provides for a written stipulation containing a couple of things. This written stipulation, as I view it, doesn't meet the requirements of the Racine County case. Do you view it differently?
I do view it differently in the sense that the actual stipulation form was the one step. The actual interaction that his attorney was able to have with him in a confidential manner before and at right before the hearing makes a difference. They did present it to the court, and in this case, because Aaron was objecting to the actual medications, there was an open hearing. And no, the judge did not enter into a colloquy as to that stipulation. However, I would suggest that if any attorney has a reservation as to a person signing that stipulation, thus giving up their rights and entering into a commitment, they would present that as an issue before the court.
Counsel, I don't quite understand. I need help with that answer. I mean, the language in Racine County says the stipulation for waiver of a jury trial must contain the following. Actually, the wording is the writing must state, rather than, that the individual has made the decision to withdraw the demand knowingly and voluntarily, and it has to state that it has done that after receiving the advice of counsel. That's not a lot. I mean, I think it could have written a lot more into the stipulation than that, but that's what it must state. And in looking at the stipulation, I don't see anything close to that, but your response seems to suggest that maybe what the attorney and the client discussed in private should in some way suffice for this requirement set forth in Racine County. That's what I'm not understanding, because it doesn't comport with what I would anticipate.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that the waiver that is here and the issue that is being waived, as you stated, the cursory, I reserve the right to a jury trial, was put on the record. And the statute specifically states that once that is done, there is a process that, including consent of the subject, that a certain process must be taken. There is no such process within Chapter 51 regarding stipulation to the actual commitment. So it would be my argument that the difference between those two waivers does not require the same sort of steps, and that the waiver that was presented to the court was sufficient to know that Aaron understood that he was being placed under commitment.
What was the waiver here? Should we look at this waiver as the right to have a trial? And I assume if there's a right to have a trial, now I'm not differentiating jury trial, court trial, that once there's a request for a trial, that there has to be a waiver. Now you can say, oh, no, what was going on here was not a waiver of the right to trial, but really it's the same thing, but rather a stipulation for no need for a trial on those grounds. I mean, isn't that the same thing as a waiver? A stipulation to the court entering an order of commitment, isn't that really the same thing as a waiver of a trial on the issues?
It is. And I was differentiating between the actual requirement for a jury itself. But you're correct. It is a waiver of a hearing on the issues that the Corporation Counsel's office would have to prove. Correct. But what I'm saying today is that there is no colloquy that is required, and or nor it should be. There is no question that a colloquy is currently not required, either by statute or by case law in the state of Wisconsin, for a stipulation to commitment.
But, counsel, if I could follow up Justice Bradley's question, you've already alluded to the fact that really 5120 doesn't contemplate this stipulated proceeding, correct?
Not in the statute, no.
All right. So if it's not in the statute, I take you back once again, because I'm troubled by the way the statute has been argued here. You still have 5110. Hasn't the legislature already made a determination that a person can voluntarily admit themselves for treatment by proceeding under 5110, and 5120 is the procedure that you use when a person is challenging the commitment, when they don't want to go into treatment? So maybe I'm missing something, but what you've appeared to do is merge the two statutes to get the benefits of a commitment under 5120 while proceeding under the procedures of 5110. Am I reading that wrong?
I don't believe you're reading it wrong. However, the statutes within 51 recognize, obviously, that there are different scenarios as to how a person comes into the system. And under 5110, it allows for a person who immediately is saying, I need help, please help me, to voluntarily to allow themselves treatment. However, under that, they are also able to, at any moment, say, you know what, I don't want it anymore. I'm fine, thank you, and be on their way.
And if I could follow up on that, long ago in a land far, far away, prior life, I worked for the Bureau of Mental Health at one point, and what would seem to be my recollection is when a person hit that point in time, what they did was they then petitioned for voluntary admission under 5110, and the commitment proceeding was dropped. Isn't that what used to happen?
I think it's a case-by-case scenario, Justice, that there are situations when a person is agreeing, I need help, and especially as we're in this case, after the probable cause hearing, which Aaron did contest, and well, his attorney contested as he was not speaking and could not agree to anything. However, there are times, and again, in practice, where the Human Services Department says, they're saying they need help today, however, we need some sort of insurance that they're going to get this treatment for the entire 6 months.
And then Human Services would file a 5120.
Correct. And we only get to the hearing process in practice really when a 5115 emergency detention happens.
With a recent overt act. Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons sometimes you'd want to keep them in on a 5120 rather than letting them do a 5110 conversion is because if they didn't last for about a couple of weeks under a 5110, you might not be able to get them back under a 5120 because of no recent overt act.
Absolutely. And that exactly, that's the point, that there has to be that dangerousness. And normally our office, I can tell you, never sees 5110s because that is a whole different realm.
When a person stipulates to a 5120 grounds for commitment, aren't they indeed stipulating to dangerousness? And if there's no factual basis to support that dangerousness finding, can the court accept the stipulation?
I believe they can, Your Honor, based upon the record before the court and the stipulation that a person can say, yes, my actions were dangerous, either to myself or others. If I was cutting on my wrist, I understand that is dangerous to self or others. Or in this case, Aaron choking his mother, that I can see now after being on medication, yes, that is dangerous. So absolutely, they could enter into that.
Counsel, I asked opposing counsel the same question. What practical effect will this have in, say, Sauk County, if the court were to require a Banger-type colloquy? Will it make any difference?
Practically, I think it will. And I think, as my opposing counsel stated, I think it will affect or result in more cases going to a full hearing. Practically, it also will mean that a person is denied the right to enter into the process of getting better without being forced to go in front of a judge and answer questions as to their mental illness, the fact that they're dangerous, and being placed in front of an intimidating process that, frankly, doesn't help their getting any better. But I believe it puts a court in a position that is not easily made, that if you are saying, okay, this is the follow this colloquy, and then you make your decision. There will always be cases when there is a concern. I will not deny that. However, there are cases when a person is clearly understanding as to these are the standards, I know what's happening, but the requirement for a colloquy should not be required because those people should not be placed in that situation.
What should be required then? I'm starting with the premise that 5125 statute says what it means. And that is, it says, and means what it says, actually. And that is, it says that there are essentials of due process and fair treatment, including the right, now I'm deleting a bit, to a hearing on the issues. You have a right, and why not? The deprivation of liberty interest that's going on here, you know, the amicus talks about this stigma of mental illness, but just the lack of deprivation of freedom, your loss of job, your loss of determination of anything that you're doing, and the possibility that this continues on for years and years and years. So I have no doubt there's a huge deprivation. You have, under the statute, a right to a hearing. My question to you is, what has to be shown when a person is going to waive that right, given the nature of the interest involved?
First, I would say that these proceedings do differ from criminal and termination of parental rights, where the colloquy has been specifically required by courts in two ways. It's not punitive and it's not permanent. So that's the starting point, that a person has the right and should be retain the right to not have to be submitted to this kind of proceeding and this kind of colloquy.
Okay. So the answer to my question, though, is given this right and considering the nature of the liberty interests involved, what has to be shown when one waives this essential of due process according to the words of the statute? What has to be shown for that in that waiver?
Well, first of all, I don't think there's any guidance either in case or statute.
That's why I'm asking you for guidance.
As far as another right that they have, I think is an essential part to this, is the right to adversary counsel. I think it's essential that the adversary counsel plays the role and fills the role of informing them of all their due process rights, but also they're the ones that are able to delve deeper into how this person is doing, what their understandings of the situation is, what they want, and why.
Counsel, do you concede that under our case law, the right to counsel, which is also one of those enumerated under 5120 sub 5, that under our case law, the waiver of that right has to be a known and voluntary waiver?
Yes, under the SY case, you're correct.
Mm-hmm. And how is that shown, the knowing and voluntariness of the right to counsel as set forth in sub 5?
Well, I think the two scenarios are distinguishable simply because in SY, the subject wanted to fight that case, and they wanted to do it on their own without counsel. And in order to do that, I think it's essential for the circuit court to check and make sure that that person knows what's going on, what their rights are, and the fact that they're going to have to do this on their own. In this case, Aaron had an attorney with him the entire process.
And so what has to be shown in this case in order to waive this other right that's set forth in sub 5? That's what I'm looking for.
I believe the answer is I don't believe there needs to be a showing that it's knowing and voluntarily, intelligently. I think the court, by agreeing to the stipulation or accepting the stipulation, needs to make a finding that they are satisfied that the person is freely entering into this. Okay. after the counsel and they discuss.
Let's take the situation where the person involved is acting out the court strangely, not consistent with the nature of the proceedings. Okay. Does the court just accept the stipulation because there's adversary counsel there?
No, absolutely not.
So if there's an indication in open court that the person is may not be competent to waive the may not be competent to enter into a contract or a stipulation, the judge has to do something. Is that your position?
I believe that is my position, that it discusses the discretion of a circuit court.
But if the person involved, what do you mean discretion? I mean, assuming that I'm absolutely right and the person's really just out of it and all reasonable people would agree, the court has to do something, right, to see if persons can enter voluntarily and knowingly.
Okay. Correct. And I would submit that one has to assume that an attorney would not allow that person to enter into a stipulation.
No, he was okay yesterday when we signed the stipulation, Judge. Maybe the meds have worn off. Maybe he's having a different reaction. Maybe there's another problem. Yesterday he was okay. Today, I mean, people do change, right?
Correct. I think, Your Honor, that shows that while I'm advocating that this is not required, it also isn't prohibited.
Well, counsel,
what isn't prohibited or required?
A circuit court, as you said, saying, okay, I'm seeing things here that make me wonder as to this person's ability to enter into agreement. I need to, for myself, figure that out.
Mm.
Now, counsel, the problem I have with the argument that you advance, and I think you advance it very well, quite frankly, is the fact that I'm not sure that the legislature contemplated the proceeding that you are defending. The legislature has contemplated a proceeding where you have voluntary admissions, and they have a specific statute on that. The legislature has contemplated under 5115 a procedure for emergency detention, and the legislature has contemplated a procedure for involuntary commitment. And maybe I'm stuck on first base, But I'm having a problem blending 5110 with 5120. And I see nothing in the statutory procedure that calls for the type of proceeding that seems to be employed in this particular case. And so if you've got somewhere where you can direct me to indicate that, yeah, this is legitimate, the legislature contemplated it, this is exactly what we expect to see in these type of cases, I guess I need to hear that.
I don't think you're misreading it. And I obviously cannot say what the legislation intended, I believe you have to recognize that it's a flexible due process system that 5151 practices under. And while 5110 does cover the voluntary commitment type scenario, and 5115 does allow for emergency detentions leading to an involuntary commitment, I believe that there needs to be an understanding that along the process of once you start down the road of involuntary detention, that a person still is competent to enter into contracts and agree that, you know, I do need help, but for whatever reason, the voluntary isn't going to work out. I understand and I agree with you that...
Assuming that that's all reasonable and makes perfect sense, the question remains, what is the legislative procedure that's designed to deprive a person's liberty interest that has been set forth? We just can't fashion a rule that says we can commit somebody because we think they're dangerous. The legislature has done that, and they've set forth different statutory requirements. And I guess I'm failing to see where the legislature has okayed a stipulated commitment.
I believe it goes along with the idea that they are given all of these due process rights under 5120. And I would propose and I would argue that you're right, the legislature did not say, here's how you do a stipulation. However, they also did not say, before any kind of waiver of these rights can happen, there must be a colloquy.
Now, but my point is even more basic than that. Where do they say that you can do a stipulation at all? Where do they say that you can waive at all?
They do not.
That's my problem.
Is there any legislative history on that issue?
Not that I'm aware of. And the changes in 51 came out of the Lessard cases, or Lessard cases, however you pronounce that, Lessard. And my apologies to Ms. Lessard. And at the time that those cases were happening, which was 1972 and 1974, the standards were much, much different for mental commitments. And the whole situation was the moment you were entered into the realm of mental commitments, you lost rights. You were not able to vote. You were not able to drive a car. So that is the scenario that we're coming from. Today, that is not the case. And that just because the legislature did not specifically allow for a stipulation, it is our contention that a person still has that right under 5159. They remain competent even after being committed to enter into contracts, to manage their own affairs, et cetera, make a will. You know, that to me argues that it must be allowed unless specifically required that a colloquy has to be done beforehand, and there's no case law and no statute that says that.
Could I ask, where did this stipulation come from? What is your account of how this happened?
My office did prepare that document and present it to Ms. O'Rourke when she said she was going to be going and visiting Aaron at the hospital.
You did it. Do you do that in every case when a jury trial is requested?
Not specifically for jury trial. It is a document that is presented, especially if, I guess there's always a possibility a person will get to a hearing and say, you know what, I agree. I don't want to go through this hearing. I don't want to go into that court. It is not, the jury trial doesn't really come into it at all. But it is a document that is presented in the possibility that the subject wants to do that.
Does this happen in every case?
As far as a person stipulating?
Yeah.
No, absolutely not. In fact, There are...
I mean, do you prepare this document in every case?
Yes. Well, unless there's a clear either indication from counsel or from the doctor's reports that show this person will not agree.
Are there other counties that utilize the stipulation procedure?
I believe so, yes. I cannot speak specifically, but in speaking to other corporation counsels, there are.
Counsel, I wrote down in my notes that one of your responses was this with regard to my questions, knowing and voluntary. Does not have to be knowing and voluntary, but the court has to be satisfied that the person is freely entering into it. Does that, do you agree with that, or does that capture, I may not have...
Yes, I believe so.
So my question is, how is the court to be satisfied that the person is freely entering into it?
I believe the court must be satisfied based upon the fact that all of the parties, the person, their attorney, and the corporation counsel are entering into this agreement.
Yeah, that's what your argument goes down to. Trust me. And I don't trust. And this, your argument boils down to what else you said, and I wrote down, one has to assume that an attorney would not allow her to enter into it if not okay. So there seems to me to be a disconnect. You're saying the court has to be satisfied that the person is freely entering into it, and the evidence to meet that requisite satisfaction that it's done freely is the fact that they're entering into it, because they wouldn't enter into it. The attorney wouldn't enter into it if it wasn't freely and voluntarily done. I mean, that's what your argument distilled to its essence is, I think, with regard to that. That's all. There's no other showing. It's just that they wouldn't do it unless it was okay. Well, in fact, you said that. One has to assume an attorney would not allow her to enter into it unless, if not okay.
That's correct. And it shows that it's our contention that the role of adversary counsel is the best place for this sort of discussion to happen.
So in my example, if the individual is not acting out but sits very quietly at the counsel table, well-groomed, shows no signs of agitation or distress or anything else, smiles at the appropriate times, doesn't smile at the appropriate times, and a stipulation is presented. Judge need not delve further to determine whether this person voluntarily and knowingly entered into the stipulation. Doesn't have to say to the lawyer, is your client under medication now? When did you talk to your client? How long did you spend with your client on this? Did you explain 6 months and it's renewable? Did you explain possible problems thereafter, even if he's released, blah, blah? Judge doesn't have to do it. Looks okay in person, looks okay on the record, and there's a stipulation. That's it. That's the county's position?
Yes, it is. And I recognize that there are, obviously, this is a situation where it's always not black and white.
Right. I gave you the two extremes, and there may be something in between. And if there's something in between, as I understood your argument, then it's within the discretion of the trial court to ask further questions to satisfy the trial court that this was a knowingly and voluntarily entered into stipulation.
Absolutely. And in addition, it is also the possible scenario where that counsel raises the issue, that their own counsel raises the issue. Corporation counsel says, I don't feel right even presenting this stipulation to a person. And so there's been layers of discretion there.
Mr. Hendy, if I may, Chief.
Go ahead.
Aaron was committed on June 11th, 2003.
Correct.
What has happened since then?
In December of 2003, Aaron once again stipulated to an extension for 12 months. Aaron's extension lapsed in December of 2004, and he is currently not on commitment anymore.
So we have a mootness problem here?
It could be found that way, yes. Other than this is an issue that may come up again. But Aaron currently is not under commitment. That is correct.
Well, what was he released under? That the stipulation ended, or that he was no longer dangerous to himself or others? Why was he released?
His commitment time extended, and the Sauk County Human Services Department chose not to request an extension, which is obviously the whole idea of Chapter 51, is to make these people better to the point where they don't need a commitment.
Was there any colloquy on the second stipulation?
While I did not handle that hearing, my understanding is no, there was not. And Aaron signed it once again.
Of course, there's still do him more than he's already released as a practical matter. So we can ask Aaron's counsel why this is persisting, because there may be collateral issues here. Right?
Correct.
Okay, and we'll find out what they are. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Handy. Ms. Badish.
Sorry. With respect to the mootness argument, certainly this issue comes up all the time in the mental commitment proceedings, and it's an incredibly important public policy interest to iron this issue out and to set forth what should be required when someone is waiving such important liberty interests.
What are the personal, any effect on Aaron J.J. as to decision in this case?
No.
Can't change the fact that he was committed for a year and a half.
That's correct. That's correct, and I believe the petition was filed while he was under commitment before the extension even occurred.
What difference would it have made in your case had there been a knowing and voluntary colloquy?
If the court found that Aaron did indeed understand what he was doing, there wouldn't have been any difference. But if the court found that he did not understand what he was doing, then the county would have been forced to put on their burden of proof. I don't know what the evidence was.
For what? I mean,
in order to take away that liberty interest.
Let me go back to this once more. If the court had found that the stipulation wasn't knowing and voluntary, how do we know that he would have been competent to go through whatever subsequent hearing there was?
I don't know that we know. That's the problem, is we don't know whether he was competent or not.
Ms. Leitch, I find both your argument and the argument of opposing counsel somewhat, maybe amusing is the wrong term, but in the sense that I think Sauk County is seeking to presume competence of your client while committing him, and what you're trying to argue is that your client is incompetent while you're challenging the commitment. Mm-hmm. So I find some irony to that. But my question goes to this. You've argued that there should be a colloquy that takes place, and my question is, in the absence of statutory authorization for a procedure that's being advocated here, would a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary colloquy, is it statutorily authorized? Can you even have it, given 5110 and 5120?
I don't know that. Well, statutorily?
There seems to be no statutory procedure for what took place here. And as I understand it, we're talking about the deprivation of a person's liberty interest, and I think you can only do that by statute. So I guess my question is, what authorizes the procedure that took place here, even if we accept your point of view? Can you do it?
Well, it was done in SY, and there was no statutory requirement for a colloquy to waive the right to a jury and to waive the right to counsel.
But that issue wasn't necessarily waived.
wasn't necessarily raised in this way. I didn't go back and look at the briefs. But, you know.
Justice Butler's issue, no, that wasn't waived.
That's right. It wasn't raised, so the fact that SY took a stipulation generally would not rule on the issue. I'll ask Justice Butler's question in a slightly different way, okay? Would the system work if you just took the view that there are three ways of doing this? Emergency detention, which we've set aside, voluntary commitment, involuntary commitment. And if it's under involuntary, which has various advantages for the county, like dangerousness, recent acts, for example, if you have two systems, voluntary and involuntary, that if involuntary means you are fighting, if you are agreeing, then you can only do voluntary. Does the system work? Can it work that way?
I believe that it can. And part of my looking at this case and listening to counsel's argument is if Aaron wanted help and was willing to accept it, why not do a voluntary? And in that way,
do a voluntary for the reasons that some members of the bench explained. You lose the most recent acts. The person can sign himself out any time.
Certainly. And
so I have to start the procedure again. All that's very wasteful. In the interim, can hurt somebody.
I don't necessarily believe that it's wasteful. If the person is willing to accept the help and then they change their mind.
Look, we're dealing with individuals who have a disability that requires a showing of a recent overt act of dangerousness. You know, so we're not just talking about helping people. We're talking about a certain amount, there's a balance here of safety also. So it concerns me, this idea that we, in some instances, in some cases not as much as others, but it concerns me, this idea that you can float in and back between 5110 and 5120. I mean, I wouldn't.
Then the argument that Aaron wanted to do this should and wanted the help should drop. They should indeed proceed with the involuntary commitment. But to come back and say, well, he wanted it, so we should let him do it, without any showing that he knows exactly what he's doing, to me doesn't make sense. And the consequences of what occurs, which is significant.
Was when the petition for review was filed, was Aaron still in custody?
I don't believe that he was in custody. He's been in community-based treatment, I believe, the whole time. He's been in community-based treatment. He was held at the emergency detention. He was held at, I believe, Mendota for a period of time until the commitment occurred. I believe he then leveled out on his meds and was released into community-based treatment.
He's still under the department's control in community-based treatment.
At the time
treatment.
That the petition was filed, yes.
That's the question.
Yes, okay. He was.
And after that, he was released totally.
A year and a half later, I believe, yes.
Have something. We received the petition for review on December 2nd, 2004. And I thought Mr. Hendy indicated that sometime in December 2004, the 1 year ran out or something like that.
I believe he was had the year and then the extension. Yes, I don't know what date he was released.
Well, I have another kind of question that's in the same vein. If nothing can be done for Aaron J.J. and nothing will affect him, sometimes you reverse a conviction even though he's spent the time in prison, you know, it can affect habitual, criminal, etc. Who do you represent?
Oh, who do I represent? Initially, I represented Aaron for whatever fortuitous facts he was released. He could have just as easily not been released.
Okay. And so you're just continuing with the case because initially it would have helped you, or might have.
Correct, and then the public policy interest in this case.
That ends. Thank you, Ms.
Thank you.
Which that ends our hearing on 03AP3349 Sauk County versus Aaron J.J. If counsel would approach the bench, please. Is this your first time here?